Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staber. Do you need special skills to do something extraordinary? Or do you simply need passion, a drive to keep going when others would have stopped? We're talking this hour about the kind of drive that motivated a doctor to build weekly walks with his patients into a worldwide Walk with a Doc movement, or the passion that pushed a Reiki practitioner to give her services away for free, or the inspiration needed to reimagine how MRIs work. Orlando Simonetti is a professor of cardiovascular medicine here at Ohio State University. He spent his career creating clear images of people's beating hearts. His work has transformed the way we diagnose conditions like coronary artery disease and congenital heart disease, allowing doctors to see and treat problems without ever picking up a scalpel. And to this day, his research paper on something called the LGE pulse sequence is one of the 100 most cited articles in medical imaging literature. It's quite a CV, and Dr. Simonetti joins me now in studio. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I understand that you happened upon this career in magnetic resonance imaging somewhat by accident.
Yeah, I got my PhD at Case Western in MRI and then went to work for Siemens Medical Systems. And when I walked in the door, they said, hey, we need somebody to work on this cardiac MRI technique. That's your job. And that was in 1992, and I've been working on cardiac imaging ever since.
You joined a team with an old friend of yours, an old Ohio State grad. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, at Case Western, I did.
Yeah.
That was Dr. Jeff Dirk was my PhD advisor there, but we had met as students here at Ohio State together.
And so the focus of your work, it seems, and you know way more about MRI technology than I will ever know, but it seems that you focused on improving the technology by making it less sensitive to motion. So I'm hoping you can walk us through about why that's so important.
Sure, yeah. If you've ever had an MRI, and most commonly that would be of one of your joints or brain or spine, the scans take on the order of several minutes. And that's fine. You can hold your legs still or your head still for that long. But to image the beating heart or the abdominal organs that are moving, the motion becomes a real problem. So that's been, a big part of the focus of my career has been...
It blurs the image.
Right, it does. It not only blurring, but creates artifacts, which we call, which are kind of structures that don't really exist, but appear in the image due to that motion. So to image the heart and blood vessels, that's a key, is to manage that motion by synchronizing with the beating heart, with the breathing, or by having the patient hold their breath and other techniques.
I wonder, is a good way to think about it the difference between taking a portrait of someone standing still or trying to snap a picture of them while they're running across the field?
Right, yeah. And in fact, with the heart, we often take videos, essentially. They're cine images where, it's important to see how the heart's functioning. So we'll run, basically acquire a movie of the beating heart to look at that.
So how did you make a machine that could take a movie?
I guess I wasn't responsible for that, but you basically break up the scan into pieces so that you can put together frames across many heartbeats into one movie of the beating heart.
And you've essentially spent the last 30 years working on perfecting this technique. That's a lot of time to dedicate to imaging the heart. What made you decide, you know what, this will be my life's work?
Yeah, I guess it's always, I feel like it's never solved completely. There are always things we can do to look at the heart and blood vessels in different ways, look at inflammation and fibrosis and other things that may go wrong with the heart muscle. There's always more to do, and the technology is always changing. So it's really been exciting. I just feel like it's never done and probably never will be.
You've been working with Nationwide Children's Hospital and Dr. Amy Armstrong, a pediatric cardiologist there, about ways to make these MRI scans easier on children. And I find this fascinating because, yeah, I mean, you look at those machines, and if you're in any way claustrophobic, it probably is terrifying.
Right, right. Yeah, the Dr. Armstrong is actually an interventional cardiologist, so she does catheter-based interventions in children with congenital heart disease, where they need repair and restructuring of blood vessels or structures in the heart. And that intervention is typically done under X-ray fluoroscopy guidance, which means there's the use of radiation and exposure of radiation to the patient and also to the physicians who are doing this on a daily basis. So MRI offers an alternative to that where there's no radiation. So I've been working with Dr. Armstrong to develop these techniques, not just to get images of the heart, but to be able to guide interventional procedures in real time. So where Amy can thread a catheter, deploy stents, for example, all while viewing the images under MRI guidance.
But how does she get in the machine? Like, you have to redesign the entire machine to make this work.
Yeah, so the machine we're working with, it's developed by Siemens. It's a low-field MRI, so it's got about one-third the magnetic field strength of the most common clinical machines. So that makes the wires and catheters that are used for these interventions safe to use at low field, where they couldn't be at higher field. And the machine also has a much bigger opening, so it's an 80-centimeter patient bore diameter. So that allows Dr. Armstrong the room to get in there and do these procedures by catheter. It also makes it much easier for claustrophobic patients to have an MRI, and severely obese patients can fit in this machine where they may not have other imaging options available.
The technology also makes it safer with patients with implants, like your wife, who has a pacemaker.
Right, yeah. So pacemakers, defibrillators, any kind of implanted devices, there can be the risk of heating at higher magnetic field strength. A lot of that has been alleviated with new pacemaker technology where patients can get MRIs routinely, but lower magnetic field just lowers the risk even more.
How has your wife's diagnosis influenced your work?
Yeah, I mean, I was already working on cardiac MRI at the time, but it was she was diagnosed in 2017 with dilated cardiomyopathy. And yeah, it really hit home for me that the work that I've been doing and continue to do can benefit her. And she has benefited from it. She's had multiple cardiac MRIs here at Ohio State. And it's really shown the tremendous improvement in her heart with the therapy she's received from the implanted device and from the pharmaceuticals that she's able to take.
I want to play a quick clip of your wife, Lynn, from a 2022 interview.
I've always been very proud of what he's done, and I knew that he was helping cardiac patients, but to become one of those patients and to benefit from what he and other researchers have developed has been amazing.
I guess we never know where life is going to lead us, but it's such a strange, I don't know if there was ever somebody's partner, like you're the guy building the technology that essentially is helping her live longer.
Yeah. I mean, cardiac MRI in that sense is a diagnostic tool. So it you know, it's not what has, helped her or cured her, but it has been an important tool in guiding her treatment and evaluating the effectiveness of her therapies.
Because you don't have to cut somebody open to see how it's working.
Right.
You can just peer inside.
Yeah, they call it a virtual biopsy sometimes. Yeah, that you can basically biopsy the tissue non-invasively. Really has eliminated the concept of exploratory surgery that used to be a thing, where now we can do that all non-invasively.
Because exploratory surgery always comes with risks of infection, risks of anesthesia. I mean, we think of surgery, I think, sometimes to a certain extent as routine, but there are always risks associated with going under the knife.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So the more we can do non-invasively or under MRI guidance, the better.
And, you know, MRI now, what I find fascinating, we're living in this world where it seems to be for the exclusively wealthy at the moment, but getting MRIs just as baseline scans, just to like annual scans, just to see what you look like on the inside before you ever even have a whiff of being sick.
Yeah, the cost would have to come down considerably, I think, to be a screening tool like that. But
it's fascinating to see that like people are doing it, right? They're, I mean, obviously they're paying out of pocket. They have the money to pay out of pocket.
Right. Yeah, this low field MRI machine that we're using now and researching here also brings the cost down considerably of the not only the MRI machine but the installation, the maintenance. So that's been a big part of the motivating factor as well. As you know, there are a lot of parts of the world and even parts of this country that really don't have good access to MRI. We're spoiled here in Columbus where there are dozens of machines everywhere, but a lot of parts of the country, that's not true. And bringing that cost down, I'm hoping makes a considerable impact on the accessibility.
Yeah, it's also, it sounds like you've brought down the noise and the magnetic field, so they're getting quieter and easier to use, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. The I guess the downside to all that and it in going to lower field is that there's less signal available. But there's been a lot of advances in the on the software side in using artificial intelligence and other methods to extract more signal out and suppress the noise so that we can get high quality images from this lower field. There's probably, I'm sure there will always be applications for higher field systems where really high level of detail is needed in neuroimaging or musculoskeletal imaging. But there are a lot of applications where, you know, if the other option is no MRI, then certainly low field has something to offer.
I understand that some of your work has involved pigs.
That's true, yeah.
Because pigs have surprisingly similar hearts to humans.
Right, yeah. So like these, developing the interventional techniques along with Dr. Armstrong, the first stages of that is to test devices and imaging techniques in pigs, where we'll implant stents and do the interventional procedures there first. We're hoping that this will move into patients then probably in the next year or so. Nationwide Children's Hospital is going to be installing a similar machine, and we'll be able to move these techniques that we're developing then into actual clinical use there.
One of the things I love about that work with Nationwide Children's is that they're also creating a Gerda the Brave giraffe. There's a stuffed animal. There's a book. There's this really holistic approach to thinking about how do we make these big medical procedures easier on small children.
Yeah, there's a lot of effort in that. The I'm sure the large bore opening will help alleviate fears. And there's also, you know, you can play music through headphones. You can watch videos in the room. So a lot of steps taken to make it easier for patients and children especially.
It's a lot different than the MRIs of the early 90s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, where, I mean, the tube was so narrow and long, you felt like you were getting into a tomb when you'd get into those magnets.
That is not the analogy that you want when you're going in for a major medical evaluation.
True, yeah. Yeah. In fact, when I started, they were kind of built, a wall was built around them, so it looked literally like you were going into a hole in the wall when you got in the MRI.
Was that because of the magnetic pull? Because I've heard that the magnets on the early MRIs were strong enough to lift up cars.
Yeah, I mean, they're still on that order of strength. So the you know, the biggest danger with MRI is that somebody inadvertently comes in the room with something that's ferromagnetic, so something that would be attracted to a magnet. That's the largest risk involved. Again, there's no radiation involved or anything like that. But you do have to be very careful and vigilant that no one comes in the room with anything that would be attracted to the magnet.
So what's next? What's the next iteration of the MRI? What are you working on for the future?
Yeah, I mentioned artificial intelligence. There's really a lot being done on that side now with automated interpretation of the images and kind of drafting a report and a diagnosis automatically.
Oh my goodness.
using AI. So that's a huge field of research. There's a great bioinformatics department here at Ohio State, and we're working closely with them to develop that kind of technology.
That's one of the fascinating things, I think, about working at a place like Ohio State is that you have computer programmers that you can tap. You have AI experts you can tap. You have all these different disciplines and really talented people across all these different divisions.
Yeah, absolutely. That's been fascinating here. I've been able to work with experts in virtually any field, whether it's exercise physiology or mechanical engineering or chemistry. They're all here. Yeah, it's an amazing benefit of working here at Ohio State.
Yeah, you've been working on some like treadmill MRIs, which I will admit, I read it a couple times. I do not fully understand how that works.
Yeah, for cardiovascular imaging, it's often important to stress the heart to see. That's when patients have symptoms. They're short of breath with exertion. So we want to see what's happening with exercise. So there are different ways to do that. And one that we explored was to position a treadmill just outside the MRI, so a patient would run on the treadmill and get up to peak stress and then get in the magnet. And there we had to develop very rapid imaging techniques to image them post-exercise. Now we're doing exercise in the magnet, so there's kind of a cycle device that mounts to the magnet table, and patients will exercise while we're imaging their heart and see what's happening under stress conditions.
Oh, my goodness. That must feel like sci-fi to where we were in the early 90s.
Yeah, it's really exciting, and I'm really helping with the kind of diagnosis we can make where there's no comparable type technology, what we can do with that.
That was Orlando Simonetti, professor of cardiovascular medicine here at The Ohio State University. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Coming up, how another Ohio heart doctor inspired communities across the country to connect through walking. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Every year, more than 8,000 walks take place over 48 states in the U.S. Communities come together to get outside, get to know each other, and learn about their health. The walks take place through a program called Walk with a Doc. Joining me today is Dr. David, an Ohio Health cardiologist and the founder of Walk with a Doc. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you for having me. Good morning, Anna.
Good morning. So Walk with a Doc started right here in Central Ohio. What inspired you as a cardiologist to want to get outside with your patients?
Great question, important question. There's really nothing I can do as a cardiologist that can compare with the magical powers of going for a walk and all the more doing it outside. So I was having conversations with my patients, thousands of them, while I was a resident fellow at Ohio State. And I just wasn't able to affect change like I wanted. So one day I wanted that patient to have to say no to my face.
So you got outside and you took a walk. And what was it about? Was it that moment that you knew you wanted to keep doing it, or was it just like looking back, you know, that was the moment, but it took a little longer?
We asked that first patient in November of 2004, and the response from our office and around the community was phenomenal. So we knew right out of the gate that we had stumbled on something pretty special.
And so what are walks with docs?
Yeah.
What do we get if we show up?
Awesome. So the doc will speak at the beginning for a few minutes, answer questions, anything any of our guests have questions on. And a lot of times in the office, we are, you know, we're limited to X amount of time. And this is kind of a nice pop-off valve where we're out under trees and walking and there's unlimited time and there's that great opportunity for social connection. And then, of course, we walk. Everyone goes at their own pace, their own distance. You're going to make friends, see old friends. It's again, we got really lucky into stumbling into something very special.
And when do these walks happen? If somebody's listening and like, oh, I think I'd show up to one of those.
Oh, we would love it. They are all over. A lot of them are Saturday mornings. Our website, walkwithadoc.org, has many times and locations throughout Central Ohio. And then if you're traveling here or abroad and you would like to do it, we'd love to have you.
You know, that's got to be such a, I don't know, a fulfilling idea that you have this website, that they're happening all over the country, in places all over the world. Like, and it started right here in Central Ohio with you and a patient.
We love Columbus, and we are so honored to be able to export this, if you will. And we're very happy with 570 plus chapters, but we are nowhere near where we need to be. So while we are happy, we are constantly looking forward to thousands of chapters.
Yeah, you've also gotten some national attention. You have recognition from the U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, and you've been honored as a CNN hero. It's got to be kind of surreal.
Well, thank you for that. We're just kind of moving forward one day at a time. And again, with the power of walking and what, you know, and if walking's not your thing and you like swimming or cycling or running, you know, just as great. But it's not only reducing heart attacks, strokes by 50%, can reduce Alzheimer's by 50%, arthritis, anxiety, depression. There are literally dozens of diseases. So we do have the miracle drug, and I'm so proud of our doctors around the world that are volunteering their time and making this happen.
Yeah, because, you know, swimming, running, cycling, these are all great exercises, but walking is one you can do while talking. You can build community while you exercise.
So critical to what's going on right now. Dr. Murthy has a great book called Together, where he believes we have an epidemic of social isolation. I could not agree more. So we need connection. We need to be together. We saw that over the last few years, all the more so. So while this was initiated for physical activity, that the X factor is social connection and all the friendships that people are making.
I want to talk a little bit about the benefits of walking, because I think sometimes, I don't know that we denigrate it, but we don't look at it as like, it's like, that's not real exercise.
I hear that all the time. But it is. It's just as good as running. It just takes a little longer. And, you know, the benefits into what I mentioned, there's also there's 13 cancers that are dramatically reduced with walking. Breast cancer can go down upwards of 50%. There's so many things that we can do. And if there was one pill that had all these powers, we wouldn't be able to afford it. We wouldn't be able to find it. And yet it's right there in our sneakers.
You've had a lot of different healthcare providers from all across different disciplines come and give these talks. I want to know, have you learned things from listening to these other medical professionals?
Absolutely. Not only from the medical professionals, but probably more from the community members. We've had consultants and surveys and studies over the years, and we've learned that the docs are getting just as much, if not more, out of this than the guests.
Oh, I love that. What are some of the things you've learned from the people who've joined you?
Yeah, you learn about it breaks down barriers. We're learning more about the things that we may not talk about in the 15 to 30 minute visit. If it's their surroundings, going more in depth, their diet, their fears, their concerns, things that may not come out in, you know, the sterile four walls of an office, but when you're out there in nature, it just kind of comes out.
Yeah, and I wonder if sometimes there's less pressure if it's not your doctor. Because I think sometimes some of us, I don't know, we have that feeling of not wanting to look a certain way to our doctor, if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. We have a lot of attendees that may want a second opinion, and they don't have to worry about copays or bad news. There is something nice about it being with another physician.
Yeah, I think that's one of those challenges is, as silly as it sounds, not being honest with your doctor.
Yeah.
Afraid to be truly honest about how you're living.
Yeah. And again, with the limited time that sometimes we have, these conversations, ideally they're an hour long or longer, and you can get into that on the trail.
Yeah, I think it takes a certain level of vulnerability to be honest with people.
And it sure does. You don't want to be second-guessed by anyone.
So you've been doing this for about 2 decades now. That's quite a length of time. How has it changed the way you practice medicine day-to-day in your clinic?
Very important question. I would say that the relationships that have been established over the 19 years make the visits very, you're kind of seeing an old friend as opposed to someone new. And then what I love is while the walks are, you know, the one I'm involved in, my primary one is Saturday mornings. It plays a role Monday through Friday because we're able to say at the close of a visit in just really 5 seconds, hey, would love for you to join us on Saturday morning. And there, to me, there's nothing that shows how much a healthcare provider cares about their patient that they're willing to be there on the weekend.
Yeah, that's true. You are giving up your Saturday as well, or a piece of it.
It may seem that way from the outside, but I've always felt we get back about tenfold what we put into it.
Yeah, and you're taking care of people's hearts, arguably our, well, I don't know, heart or brain, which is more important, but it's one of our most vital organs.
I'm biased, but yes, they're all important, but you got to keep the heart ticking.
You know, I wonder, since we have you and since you study and treat people's hearts, what are some things outside of walking that we can do to protect our hearts for the long term?
Yeah, great question. So the most important, one of the most important things is not smoking.
That's fair.
There was a great article on longevity in the New York Times this week, and the author said it's very boring. It's not smoking, being with others, that social connection, carrying the healthiest weight you can. Ideally, it's a BMI of 25, diet high in fruits and vegetables, and exercise. Again, I like moderate pace. It's just more the continuity and shooting for 150 minutes a week, however you...
So it's the things we've really been saying for decades.
It's boring, but that is what extends our life by 7 years. And those 7 years, and that's on average, it could be a lot more. Those 7 years are high quality years. They're not low quality.
Yeah, that's something I think about a lot as I'm getting older, is it's not just about how long I'm going to live, but how long I'm going to feel good living.
Yeah, and we talk about, you know, I've already mentioned reducing heart attacks and cancer and things like that, but the quality of our life, for many of us, that's more important than how long. And regular physical activity, if it's walking or whatever, that improves our quality tremendously. And then if you pair it with the social connection and then being in nature, it's just win, win, win.
You've talked about the friendships that have formed between the walkers. I wonder, have there ever been any romantic relationships? Have people like met through Walk with a Doc and then gone on and got married?
We have a wedding that occurred in Worcester, Massachusetts. Jim and Karen got married. I was so excited for that. Yes. Still together.
Oh, my goodness. It's, you know, of all the places you might think you would meet your spouse, maybe it'll be on a Walk with a Doc.
You never know.
So how can people get involved with the organization if they want to do more than walk?
Again, so proud of Central Ohio and the way that it's come together to make this an international offering. And you can reach out to us at walkwithadoc.org. Our email that goes to, we have two incredible people that really make this all happen, Rachel Hobash and Brian Romey. One of the three of us will get back to you right away. That's at contact@walkwithadoc, or our phone number is 614-714-0407. And if you have any questions, we're happy to answer.
And you could always start your own chapter.
We love that. We're blessed to be getting about 90 to 100 requests a month.
And, oh my goodness, that's a lot.
It's a lot. And again, Rachel and Brian, I don't know how they do it, but I'm so glad they do. And they're getting chapters started. And we would love for you to bring this to your neighborhood.
Yeah, it's so fascinating to me. I get why it caught fire, but it's just fascinating to me to think that, you know, it started with you and a patient, and now it's international. And it feels like you really tapped into something. You hit on something that, like, people were really looking for. I know that's sort of a business marketing way of thinking about it, but in a sense, that's what it is.
You know, it's 19 years later, Anna, and I still wonder exactly what it is. My best guess is it's the social connection, and then that we all need to be together. So I think that's it. It does help to have a doctor there, but that's not the critical piece. The critical piece is all of us being together.
That was Dr. David Sabger. Sabger?
Sabger, that's right.
Sabger. That was Dr. David Sabger, Ohio Health cardiologist and CEO of Walk with a Doc. One more time, what's the website to find a walk in our neighborhoods?
Walkwithadoc.org.
Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Anna.
Coming up, how a local Columbus project is bringing a Japanese healing practice to our people and our pets. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. I want to tell you a quick old fable. It's about a soldier who wanders into a village struggling with famine. The people have nothing to eat until he brings out a magic stone and uses it to make soup. The soup starts out with just the stone, and then the villagers bring out their own food, cabbage, carrots, and it builds a soup that feeds the entire village. And it's a fable, which means it has a message, which is where community comes together to help people live better, more balanced lives. It was the inspiration for the Stone Soup Project. And here to talk about that is Linda Haley, President Emeritus of the Stone Soup Project. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you so much, Anna.
So, Linda, the Stone Soup Project is about bringing Reiki healing to people and communities that might otherwise never have come into contact with it. So, first things first, what is Reiki?
Well, stone soup is actually all modalities. Reiki is the predominant one because it's coordinated primarily through the Reiki Center in Grandview. But Reiki is a Japanese technique for pain and stress reduction, started by somebody in 1921. But the concept of hands-on healing is generations, millennia old. So it's a concept that we have an energy inside of us, and we allow people to draw that energy from us. We collect it like a little antenna, and they can pull from us. So we do not push anything into you. You on the table are the one that is actually the healer.
Oh, that's such an interesting concept. How did you first come across it?
My background was primarily in traditional Western medicine, and I got into natural therapies in a way most people did. You're looking for something to supplement what you're doing with your physician's care plan. And in my case, it actually resolved a lot of physical issues And I found that I also found peace, and I found a lot of other things. And I was encouraged to look into it. Still had a full-time job, but started a small business on the side, and that little hobby kind of got away from me.
Yeah, you founded the Reiki Center here in Columbus in 2004.
20 years old this year. And, you know, I wish if I had known where I was going to be in 20 years, I probably wouldn't have called it the Reiki Center, because I want people to know that we do much more. We've got 60 or 70 different treatments that we offer, and with 35 practitioners. But Reiki is one of the things that we do there, and people seem to know us for all sorts of natural therapies.
What are some of the other things you do there?
We do a lot of therapeutic modalities that involve the physical body, massage therapy, craniosacral therapy. We can work with heart-centered issues, whether it is through hypnotherapy or past life regression. We do a lot with emotional issues, heal the heart. I know you were having some cardiologists on. We work with the emotions that people hold on to in the heart. They take care of the physical aspect for the most part, but some of the emotions that we hold on to, even since childhood, can have a physical impact on the body.
Yeah, one of the things that, you know, we hear about more and more in recent years is the physical impacts of stress.
Oh, it's significant. It's probably the number one issue that I think probably all of us in the wellness field have to deal with. And people don't realize that just the concept of something that is as difficult as a rough day can have long-term impact on you. And then get into the stuff from childhood. Wow,
yeah, ACE scores are a real thing.
Very much so. So what we do, we are not medical professionals. We make a point of letting people know that we are integrative. We're complementary to your physician care plan. We never want people to think that you have to do one or the other. But we do believe that there's a way for everybody to coexist.
So you started the Stone Soup Project in 2012, and it was about bringing this kind of supplementary wellness medicine to people who in communities who might otherwise never have come across it. How did you come up with the idea, and how did you land on Stone Soup Project?
So we actually started a couple years earlier. We started to do a free Reiki clinic. Once a month, we offer free Reiki to the general community, with people coming in on the third Monday from 6 to 8, and you just get a free session. And we realized that only works for people who can come to us. Then we thought, we need to take the services out in the community and expand it. So we're all practicing therapists and practitioners, but we volunteer to go to the YMCA, the YWCA. We work with pets. We work with Ronald McDonald House. We work in hospices. And these are people who are either medically fragile or perhaps financially needy. And this is a way for us to be able to enhance their wellness at no cost to them.
I have to imagine that's been such a rewarding endeavor.
You know, I think probably just as much for our practitioners as for the people who are the recipients. When you can go in and work on all of the hospice staff, the social workers, the nurses, the people who serve the meals, if we can keep them happy, then they can do what they do best, and that's helping their people.
One of the things I've heard about when you start hospice work is these weeks that they call the brain fog, of they forget what year it is, they might forget who the president is, they lose sense of time and place as they're adjusting to hospice work.
Oh, very much so. And I think a lot of people spend a lot of energy, and well, they should, the people who are receiving the treatments. But I don't know enough people really think about the caregivers. And this is also the family members. And this is the extended family, and it's the people who talk to and care for the family members who are perhaps dealing with this on a very daily basis.
Yeah, I would think particularly in your work with Nationwide Children's and Ronald McDonald House that as a parent, I just can't imagine watching my child go through some difficult diagnosis.
And what's interesting that we're taking a little break from Ronald McDonald House, but we're going back, we would also work on the kids. And so somebody who's going through a pretty significant, you know, treatment period, sometimes they just want to feel like they can relax for just a half an hour and just feel good vibes coming in. That's what we do.
I want to talk a little bit more about Reiki as a practice. So if somebody comes in on, say, a Monday night for a free session, or they're curious about it, what does a session look like? Like, what is going to happen?
So you're completely clothed. This is not like a massage, and people have a concern about that. You're usually relaxing on a very comfortable massage table. Sometimes you could be in a chair if that's comfortable for you. And we're going to probably just try to help you relax going into a meditation if that's something that's comfortable for you. The hallmark of people who are practitioners is your hands get warm. And that's what happens when energy starts moving through your body to help somebody. And the person on the table will usually remark on the fact that, wow, your hands are really hot. And then you'll feel a very gentle sensation move through the body. It can be pretty profound. It can go through the body fairly quickly, and your fingers and your toes may start to feel like they're tingling. It's practiced all over the world. It's not as well known in our country, but it's practiced starting in Japan, but then moving all over the world. It's pretty common right now in many other places in the world.
Do you remember what it was like the first time you had somebody put hands on you?
I do. I had never even heard of Reiki before. And actually, the first time I heard it, I was probably more than startled, probably even concerned, because it was like, this is something I've never even heard of before. This is 20-some years ago. And I had this weird floaty feeling, and I could feel a tingling vibration. And I had suffered with pretty extreme pain for years before that. But when I got off the table, my pain was gone completely. And I now realize that a lot of the pain that we hold on to are autoimmune issues. A lot of it is internalizing emotional pain. And if you can help somebody connect to that pain and release it in a very non-threatening way, sometimes there can be really profound results.
Have you seen that in your work with the Stone Soup Project and going out to these communities and places?
I have. What's really interesting is that we will see somebody and maybe lose track of them, because when we go into like the VA, we go the VA often, at least monthly, sometimes more often, you never know who's going to be on your table. But if they want to follow up, we let them know how they can reach us. And just a couple days ago, I heard from a nurse who I treated a year ago. And it's like, okay, I still remember that session. I want to find out what happened and how can I find out more about it.
Oh my goodness. So she circled back a year later.
Yeah, that's actually fairly common. I've had people who many years later have decided that I don't know what happened. I'm hearing a little bit about it and I want to find out more.
Do you ever get people who come in to the center for these free sessions who are skeptical? Because, I mean, on its face, you know, if you're somebody who grew up in Western culture, taking sure. Western medicine, it sounds a little woo-woo.
Very much so. I love skeptics. They're my number one demographic to work with. I think that they're so much fun because you can see that there's this light bulb that clicks on. We also have a lot of techniques that we use. There are tools that will show there's a transfer of energy. If two people touch together, a light will go off. So the engineers and the people who are the true hardcore scientists really love that, because then it validates that, oh, there is this thing called energy, even though you can't see it. I mean, you can't see an emotion, you can't see the wind, but you see what happens afterwards. So we kind of put it in the same category.
I like that analogy of the wind, because we know the wind exists, yeah. Obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's something that we've all found a way to be able to discuss it in a way that doesn't scare people.
So I guess, do you have long-term clients? I sort of wonder, is it a one and done? Is it like therapy that evolves over time? Is it just very individualized?
Great question. We do have people that we see often. We have some people that we see every single week. That's not because an issue is not being taken care of. It's because the profound relaxation is something that they really crave. The other thing is, once you receive treatment for one session, there's plenty of other layers to that onion. And we can just keep going deeper and deeper and deeper. Sometimes people come in for other things, like they could come in for a hypnotherapy session or for craniosacral therapy, or they might bring their children, and we have a whole children's division. So we do see people regularly, and we see entire families too.
I have a sense of what hypnotherapy is, but what is craniosacral therapy? I don't think I've ever heard that before.
Craniosacral therapy started about 40 years ago, and I'm actually a craniosacral therapist too. It's a way to be able to find restrictions in the physical body. So Reiki and some of the other energy techniques find where we hold emotions and all the things that are blocking our ability to feel, to have behaviors that work for us. But craniosacral therapy is using a very light touch. You're also fully clothed, about the weight of a nickel. So it's a very, very light touch. But we can feel where perhaps the body just feels like it's just a little out of balance. There are some techniques that are much more forceful in moving the body back into balance. We believe that a very gentle touch sometimes can have longer range effects.
So it might be good for somebody like, say, going through physical therapy for an injury. To, like as complement to the physical therapy.
And we do. We complement some of the other therapies. We usually see it for somebody who just has an achy back.
Mm.
Or maybe...
not quite rises to the level of needing to go to the doctor.
And maybe you've gone through your cycle of physical therapy or some of the other things if you've had a broken bone. And it's just a way to be able to just, you know, help you find complete wellness.
So you've been doing this for 2 decades now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Surprises me. This was, like I said, this was never intended to be a full-time job. But I am so glad that the universe pointed me in this direction.
I wonder what you think about how we talk about, how we think as a culture about the mind-body connection has changed over the last 2 decades. Because I do think, as I've gotten older, there's been a stronger, more real conversation about how our emotions impact our physical health.
We actually do. I teach a lot of classes, and we actually have an entire class on how emotions impact the body. Johns Hopkins researchers discovered something called broken heart syndrome. Well, we have always known if you get a shock emotionally, trauma, that it can impact the physical body. But now they're actually putting it into more scientific literature. So we know that stress can impact your stomach. It stirs up more stomach acid. It creates, you know, ulcers, a hiatal hernia. If you have stress that's in your emotional field, which is the second chakra, the abdominal area, there's a whole host of things that can happen in your abdomen, from nausea, diarrhea, vomiting, irritable bowel syndrome, Crohn's disease, low back pain. We've had women who could not get pregnant because they were holding on to so many emotions. We helped them to clear some of the things bothering them. They all got pregnant.
It's, you know, it's funny because, like, I do think we're just having a much more honest conversation in this country and generationally. I have found not to that, you know, millennials are far more open than their predecessors. Gen Z is incredibly open about their mental health and their status and the importance of protecting it. And it's been kind of nice to watch that sort of change culturally within us.
Excuse me. What's really nice is that we're doing a lot with children right now. And a lot of the children who are coming in to see us who are born right now have very different gifts. They're more concerned about the environment. They demonstrate more compassion. They may have memories of what it was like before they came into the physical place. So I think the reason that we're doing so well working with children is that the way that we remember growing up that, you know, you just don't worry about those things, now we're taking it seriously. We had one of my grandchildren said to his grandfather, my husband, when he was 2 or 3 years old, "I used to be your daddy." And we're hearing
that. Such a
that.
Wild thing to say. Yeah,
we're hearing that from other kids, too, that they feel like it's safe to be able to express things that, you know, maybe they can't to their peers, but they'll talk to us.
My final question for you is, what would you say to somebody who is still pretty skeptical about Reiki or sacral therapy or any of the sort of complementary therapies that you offer at the Reiki Center? What would be your elevator pitch to somebody who's like, I don't know that that's for me?
Actually, it's one of the reasons we created the free Reiki clinic. If you're curious, maybe you don't have funds for a full session, but you just want to find out what's the buzz.
There's no cost, no risk.
There's no cost. Come on in, give it a try. All the people who do it are some of our key Reiki masters. They've been doing this for a while. They can identify things. They'll make it gentle and safe. But it's a way for you to experience something, and whole families come in at once because they do it like girls' night out. I encourage you to try it. It's something that, you know, and if somebody does need to...
Do you have to make an appointment for Monday night or just walk in?
Just walk in. But if anybody does have additional questions, they can certainly contact the Reiki Center. Reiki spelled R-E-I-K-I. We're in the Grandview area. We're number one if you put in Reiki for all the searches. So please look into it. It is incredibly impactful. And you'll find some significant relaxation and other benefits.
That was Linda Haley, Executive Director of the Reiki Center for the Healing Arts and President Emeritus of the Stone Soup Project. One more time, what is your website? How do we find you online?
So go to thereikicenter.net. And if you do want to call the office, it's 614-486-8323.
Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to say thank you to the All Sides staff, which includes senior producer Marcus Charleston, producer Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, our wonderful intern producers Abigail Jump and Kira Kedar, and our board operators Cameron Howard and today's board operator Chris Johnston. And finally, thank you all so much for listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News.